I would give everyone a warm welcome this evening. It's good to see you, and we do appreciate you taking time out of your evening to be with us, to gather around the Word of God. It's good to see an interest in the Scriptures. And the meetings go on until tomorrow evening, again at the same hour of 7:30. So, if the Lord will, we look forward to seeing as many as possible back tomorrow evening for this, the final session of these ministry meetings. Now we're going to turn again, please, to the second book of Chronicles. We're dealing this evening with the second half of the life of good King Hezekiah. So we're turning to the second book of Chronicles, please. And if we were here last night, we know that we'll be turning now to the chapter number 31. 2 Chronicles, please, and reading in chapter number 31. Now, when all this was finished, all Israel that were present went out to the cities of Judah, and brake the images in pieces, and cut down the groves, and threw down the high places and the altars out of all Judah and Benjamin, in Ephraim also, and Manasseh, until they had utterly destroyed them all. Then all the children of Israel returned, every man to his possession, into their own cities. And Hezekiah appointed the courses of the priests and the Levites after their courses, every man according to his service, the priests and Levites for burnt offerings and for peace offerings to minister and to give thanks and to praise in the gates of the tents of the Lord. He appointed also the king's portion of the substance for the burnt offerings. Verse 4, moreover, he commanded the people that dwell in Jerusalem to give the portion of the priests and the Levites, that they might be encouraged in the law of the Lord. And as soon as the commandment came abroad, the children of Israel brought in abundance the first fruits of corn, wine, and oil, and honey, and of all the increase of the field, and the tithe of all things brought they in abundantly. And concerning the children of Israel and Judah that dwelt in the cities of Judah, they also brought in the tithe of oxen and sheep, and the tithe of holy things, which were consecrated unto the Lord their God, and laid them by heaps. In the third month they began to lay the foundation of the heaps, and finished them in the seventh month. And when Hezekiah and the princes came and saw the heaps, they blessed the Lord and his people Israel. Then Hezekiah questioned with the priests and the Levites concerning the heaps, and Azariah, the chief priest of the house of Zadok, answered and said, since the people began to bring the offerings into the house of the Lord, we have had enough of to eat and have left plenty, for the Lord hath blessed his people, and that which is left is this great store. Now further down, please, I just want to mention some names. Verse 14, these are the brethren who are appointed over the distribution of this offering. In verses 12 and 13, we have the brethren appointed. I'm using that expression. We have the men, I should say, appointed over the storehouses, and now the men appointed over the distribution. And Korah, the son of Imma, the Levite, the porter toward the east, was over the freewill offerings of God to distribute the oblations of the Lord and the most holy things. And next him were Eden and Miniamin and Jeshua and Shemaiah, Amariah, and Shechaniah in the cities of the priests in their set office to give to their brethren by courses, as well to the great as to the small. Verse 20, thus did Hezekiah throughout all Judah, and wrought that which was good and right and truth before the Lord his God. Verse 1 of chapter 32, after these things and the establishment thereof, Sennacherib king of Assyria came and entered into Judah and encamped against the fenced cities, and thought to win them for himself. And when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib was come, and that he was purposed to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains, which were without the city, and they did help him. Now, I don't intend to read the whole of this. We'll mention the events. Verse 20, for the sake of time. And for this cause Hezekiah the king and the prophet Isaiah the son of Amos prayed and cried to heaven. And the Lord sent an angel which cut off all the mighty men of valor and the leaders and captains in the camp of the king of Assyria. So he returned with shame of face to his own land. Verse 24, in those days Hezekiah was sick to the death and prayed unto the Lord, and he spake unto him, and he gave him a sign. But Hezekiah rendered not again according to the benefit done unto him, for his heart was lifted up, therefore there was wrath upon him and upon Judah and Jerusalem. Nevertheless, Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart. Verse 27, and Hezekiah had exceeding much riches. Further down, verse number 31, howbeit in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land, God left him to try him, that he might know all that was in his heart. Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and his goodness, behold, they are written in the vision of Isaiah the prophet, son of Amoz, and in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. And Hezekiah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the chiefest of the sepulchres of the sons of David. And all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem did him honour at his death, and Manasseh, his son, reigned at his death. Now God will bless that somewhat scattered reading of the sacred scriptures to us this evening. You would note, if you remember, to read some of the other chapters, that when the father of Hezekiah died, it is recorded that they brought him not into the sepulchres of the kings of Israel. Such was the dreadful darkness of his reign. But when this man died, they buried him in the chiefest of the sepulchres of the sons of David. That just shows the difference between the two men. Now God will bless his work. We saw last evening that chapter 29 was a chapter of cleansing, and chapter number 30 was a chapter of commemorating. When we turn our attention to chapter number 31, it is a chapter of contributing. And there they find that there is a cost and contributions to be made when the service of God is entered into. And then in chapter number 32, it's a chapter of chastening. And we find there that this man Hezekiah is tested in three specific ways. And there is a degree of chastening in how God handles him at that time. And we must ask the question that why it should be so. We will see in three ways he was tested by God. Now, we won't go over what we said last evening. Sufficient to say, if you were not here, that Hezekiah is reckoned by the writer of the Kings to be the greatest of all the kings of Judah, either who were before him and after him. And we saw last night with remarkable speed how he brought about revival in Israel. And again, the Passover, of course, was to be kept, and it was kept, and there was great revival in Israel. Now we're coming to chapter 31, where we're dealing now with the fact that there has to be a product that comes out of the keeping of the Passover. You see, when we obey the word of God, it must affect our conduct, and it must affect the way that we live. And we will see that there are four things in this chapter that all grow out of the fact that they had remember again their deliverance from Egypt. I dare say it does us well to remember again our salvation. Sad day if we ever forget that we were saved by God's grace. Sad day if we ever forget the obligation that we have because of Calvary. And we always remember, as we said to the young people, I think it was in this hall, I've forgotten, yes, I think it was on whatever evening it was, I forgot the evening. Nevertheless, it was when I was here. Nevertheless, I did say there that the 12th chapter of the book of the Romans was the start of the section that we call the demands of the gospel. Having dealt with the dissertation and the debate, the demands of the gospel. There are practical demands that are laid on us because we claim that we belong to Jesus Christ. And it is popular today to think of the blessings that he gives, but to forget well the responsibilities and the demands of the gospel. Well, here we have the demands now laid on those who have kept the Passover. It required devotion to keep it, and it requires devotion to live up to the good of it. And so we are about to see now four things in this chapter. I want you to see again, firstly, there was sanctification. You say there was sanctification before it, and so there was, and there's sanctification after it, and so there is. But now we find that there is in revival not just the sanctification of the priests and the Levite and some of these people, but they went out through the cities of Judah and they break the images in pieces and cut down the groves and threw down the high places. Look at all the previous revivals in Judah and you will find that this work had never been done before. This was a more complete, more fundamental revival than they had ever known. Right throughout the land of Judah they went. And they cut down the images and break them and threw down the high places until they had utterly destroyed them all. What a revival that was. The greatest that Judah had ever seen. Never had these groves and high places in their entirety been cut down. Here there was a fervor for the things of God. rediscovered truth, you see, creates fervor in the hearts of God's people. And this was rediscovered truth regarding the Passover. And because of that, there's a fervor in the hearts of God's people. Young brother, young sister, I'm going to say it again. You're going to get fed up listening to me saying this. And well, you'll just need to feed away. You see, here we have it. We simply have the fact that when we discover the truth of the Bible, it ought to create in our heart a warmth and a fervor for the things of Christ. When we discover in the book truth and put it into practice, it means that we really have a desire to see everything in our lives and all round about us obedient to the Master. So, there's sanctification. But in verse 2, and in verse number 2, no longer now sanctification, but setting in order. You see, Hezekiah now moves to ensure that things will continue. That's his great concern. He wants things to continue. So he appoints the courses of the priests and the Levites, everything according as it should be, so that the temple service would continue. This man wanted things to go on. I like that expression in Acts chapter 2. They continued. Hezekiah didn't want just a flash in the pan, quick revival that just then spluttered out. He didn't want an emotional thing, full of fleshly fervor that just doesn't last a week. He didn't want something that was going to depend and constantly getting stoked up by excitement. These are all fleshly things. He wanted something that would continue. Young believer, you want to go on for God. I tell you, a big part of it is sheer stickability in the normal things of life. It's not going to be mountain tops all the time. And it's not going to be valleys all the time. There's going to be a lot of plains in between. And that's Christian life. We speak about the mountain tops and the valleys, but there's a lot of plains in between. And the believer keeps going on in the mountain tops and the valleys and the plains. This man wants it to carry on. And so if you're going to be anything for God, a mark of Christ's likeness is continuation. The Lord Jesus continued steadfastly, constantly, without distraction. That's Christ's likeness. It is not excitement and fervor and jumping up and down and waving about and all that kind of thing. That's a fleshly thing. Christ's likeness equates with continuing steadfastly. And that's what Hezekiah wanted. He wanted the whole business to carry on and carry on well for God. You don't get saved for a daytime. You don't get saved for a week time. You get saved for a lifetime. And it's the business of God that we carry on. They continued steadfastly. I like that. So he set in order. They sanctified and then they set in order. But then I want you to notice from verse 3, they sacrificed. They sanctified, their sanctification, their setting in order, and now they're sacrificed. Do you notice the king's portion is given in verse 3, and then the people of Jerusalem in verse 4, and the children of Israel in verse 5. Do you see it moving out? The king's portion, the folks in Jerusalem, and then the men of Israel. I tell you, learn one or two lessons here. The example of good leadership. The king showed a good example of leadership. It's recorded that the king appointed his substance for the burnt offerings. So the king led. I tell you, the shepherds of God's flock, they don't lord it over it. It's not a promoted post. They labor amongst God's people. But they lead God's people by godly example. And this man, Hezekiah, led by godly example. And then the people in Jerusalem, you see, it seemed to ripple out. And then, of course, beyond that, the children of Israel brought in abundance. And do you know what happened? I want you to observe what happened, please. What happened was this, that for a period of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, that is 5 months, they brought of their tithes and their offerings up to Jerusalem, so much so that there were heaps everywhere, heaps of offerings everywhere. And there wasn't place enough to keep them. They brought so much. You want me to tell you? Revival touches my pocket as well as my heart. It touches my substance as well as my heart. And when I'm talking about top pocket, I'm talking not just about about money. I'm talking about all that I have. You see, folks say, how much do we give to the Lord? Well, really, the fact of the matter is, we owe him everything. Everything belongs to him. It's all his. I can well remember standing away down in Ayrshire, and I've mentioned this once when I was here before. I mention it again, because it always come to mind, you know. And standing in the pouring wet rain, waiting to go to conferences, and a brother saying, if ever I get a car, you know, you boys will be all right. Don't you worry. When I get a car, you boys will all be all right. We'll be going there in luxury, you know. Imagine you young folks reaching the age of 21 and not having a car. Was that not poverty? Well, it wasn't indeed. It was happiness, you know. Well, he got the car. You know, we used to wave as he went past. And then when you get in, you weren't allowed to put your feet in the mat. You try sitting for half an hour with your feet in mid-air. Very, very difficult. I tell you, the train was more comfortable, and so was the bus. And then you have just about to bring a portable Hoover with you when you went out. Take every reason back out, you see. I tell you this, it was to be used for the Lord, but once he got it, it became a very exclusive thing, you know. And you had to wipe your feet, and the only thing you could wipe your feet on were your trouser legs, because you didn't take a rug with you to put in the pavement and wipe them. You just say, wipe your feet, what on, you know? I tell you. You see, he'd forgotten it belonged to the Lord. My brethren and sisters, turn over just for a minute to 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians, please, in chapter number 9. And we'll read a verse. This is to do with giving. And I just want to speak about giving now. Here what we have, what I call the divine cycle of giving. Look at the divine cycle of giving. Verse 10. Now he that ministereth seed to the sower, both ministereth bread for your food, and multiply your seed sown, and increase the fruits of your righteousness. What does that mean? I want you to notice the divine cycle of giving. Stage number 1, God gives the seed. Stage number 2, the sower sows the seed. Stage number 3, the sower receives bread. Stage number 4, the sower receives a surplus. And what does he do with the surplus? He goes back to the beginning of the cycle, and he sows the seed again. Now there is the divine cycle of giving. God gives us, we sow, God meets our need and gives us a surplus, and that surplus we sow again. And the more surplus you sow, the more you will have to sow the next time round. Now, my brethren and sisters, that's the principle. You ask a farmer. When a farmer sows his seed, he doesn't take it all and eat it, because he'll have no seed corn to sow for next year. And the more seed corn that he sows, the greater will be the harvest next year, the more he'll have. Here's the divine cycle of giving. You see, the principle is this, that God gives us material, both money and whatever it is, and we sow that. Sowing in 2 Corinthians 9 is giving to the things of God. And so we sow. And on the basis of that, God gives us a return and a surplus over and above what would meet our needs so that we can sow that again. And then when we sow that again, that's us going back to the beginning of the cycle. So you've got the divine cycle of giving. That's how God works. You know, here's some arithmetic that you young believers know that the finance ministers of the world have never heard about. It is the way of having need met. And so the surplus that we have isn't always ploughed into the luxury things of life. Travel light. The surplus that we have traveled is channeled into the Lord's work. And that, in turn, of course, means that there's more of a harvest comes out, and you have more to meet your need, and you have more to give. The divine principle of giving. There is a little verse in the Bible that says this. There is that scattereth and yet increaseth. And there is that withholdeth more than is meet, and that tendeth to poverty. Put quite simply as this. Don't sow anything and you'll have nothing to sow. Don't give anything and you'll have nothing to give. Now you say, how much? Well, it's as God has prospered before God. But that's the principle. Don't give and you'll have nothing to give. Don't sow and you'll have nothing to sow. I'm not a farmer, but ask a farmer. Look, Mr. Farmer, if you want a great harvest next year, do you sow nothing and eat it all for yourself? And he would say, man, you're some farmer. Don't you know that the more I sow, the more I get? God gives me more if I sow more. That's the principle here. And that's the principle that we find in the reign of King Hezekiah. It seemed to be that the more that they gave, the more there was to give. And the remembrance of the Passover touched them in the use of their possessions. Why should it? Why should the remembrance of Passover touch them as far as their possessions were concerned? Quite simply this, because they remembered how much had been given to deliver them out of Egypt. And because of how much he has given at Calvary, though he was rich, yet for your sakes, for our sakes, he became poor. I tell you, nothing we give can compare to what he gave. And when we think back at the cost of redemption, that touches us and moves us as far as our possessions are concerned. My brethren and sisters, you know, don't you, there's something just not very pleasant about a miserly, mean, kind of Scrooge type of believer. As tight-fisted, as they say, that every time he opens his wallet, there's a little moth flows out and meets you. You know, that kind of thing. There's something wrong about that. Our God is a liberal God. Our God is a giving God. And these men in the reign of Hezekiah, they respond to that. And by the goodness of God, there's heaps in Jerusalem. Now, I want you to notice, please, that there's not only sacrifice, but there's stewardship. How the heaps were used. Sacrifice. Sanctification. We've seen that. Setting up. We've seen that. Sacrifice. We've seen that. And now stewardship. How they handle the things of God is of exceeding importance. And King Hezekiah ensures that there were men over the warehouses and then over the distribution. You see, the same principle is found in the Acts of the Apostles. Remember, 7 men of honest report, good report had to be looked out. When that problem cropped up, you know, the problem between the Hebrews and the Greek widows as to who was getting most in the daily distribution. And there was 7 men. I often wondered why it was 7 men. Why was it 7 men? And then I wondered if the apostles had in mind that Hezekiah put 7 men over the distribution here during his reign. There was men over the warehouse, the warehouse men, but the men over the distribution to ensure that it was properly distributed. In verse 14 and 15, there are 7 men. And it may well be that that was maybe what the apostles had in mind. 7 men over the distribution. Here we have it here. And they distributed to the priests, and they distributed to the Levites, and they distributed the things of God so that the priesthood would function in a healthy way. They are sacrificing for the continuation of the testimony. Now, I've got to leave this behind and jump down quickly. But what a scene this was. You think of the heaps in Jerusalem, the generous heart of God's people, the men over the warehouses, and 7 men. Sufficient to say there's great wisdom in the fact that one man wasn't put over this business. There's great wisdom in handling financial matters to know that there's more than one, all involved. Not only that we doubt anybody's honesty, but so that no charge can ever be placed against anyone of dishonest behavior. So there was the men there, over the storehouses, and over the distribution. It's interesting to note, if you look through the men over the warehouses, you'll find, for instance, there's a descendant of Samuel. Now you just think of that. He could have said, you know, well, I really deserve a promoted post, you know. After all, I'm descended from Samuel. Well, I'll go over the warehouses, but only if I'm the managing director, or what do you call me, or the president, as you call me, I don't know. Whatever it is. The Hegian, anyway, the one in charge. He's the man. I want to be the man in charge. No, a descendant of Samuel, but he's still prepared to take his place amongst the others. Just doing the work. There was stewardship. There was care in the things of God, and that's how we ought to be. Chapter 32. This takes place halfway through his reign. If you look carefully, you will see that this is a mid-reign crisis. It's halfway through his reign. He reigned for 29 years, and this comes in the 14th year of good King Hezekiah. It's halfway through his reign. You see, it seems to be oftentimes that happens. Halfway through something, the devil attacks. Halfway through, there are doubts. Halfway through, the problems arose. He was tested in three ways. He was tested by struggle, then he was tested by sickness, and then he was tested by strength. You say, how can a man be tested by his strength? Well, we'll see that today. He was tested by struggle. Now, I've got to give you a little history lesson, because we've got to get the background to what happened, and I'll take 2 minutes to give you a history lesson. I know for a fact that not everybody in here likes history, but nevertheless, we'll give you a little history lesson. So just listen, because there is purpose, and don't switch off for 2 minutes. I want you to observe, please, the history lesson. First of all, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, invades Judah, because the northern kingdom has gone now. He invades Judah, and his armies move to the south of Jerusalem. Stage number one in the campaign. He takes the ten cities of Judah. That's stage number one. Stage number two, he detaches from his forces a huge army under the command of such men as Tartan, who didn't come from Scotland, and men such as Rabshakeh, and they are detached from the main force to besiege Jerusalem. Stage number two. Jerusalem is now besieged. This is despite the fact that Hezekiah has sent gold and other things to Sennacherib to buy him off. But nevertheless, they besiege Jerusalem. Stage number three, we'll see in 2 Chronicles 32, the king arranges the defences of Jerusalem. He arranges them by seeking to cut off the water source for the invading army. That's what we find at the beginning of chapter 32. The next thing is that there is a dialogue between the invader and the men of Jerusalem. And we'll find, of course, that dialogue led to nothing, really. Just led to nothing. Well, what happens after that? What happens after that is that Hezekiah sends for Isaiah, and they pray. They pray. And he is told that Assyria will be defeated. The Assyrians send Hezekiah a letter, and he spreads it out before the Lord. Spreads it out before the Lord. And then, of course, this invading force, it seems it'll never go. A huge invading army. He spread it out before the Lord. And then, as Isaiah had prophesied, one morning when they get up, there are 185,000 dead Assyrians at the gates of Jerusalem. God struck them down in a night. The king, the Assyrian invader, returned to his capital. He was murdered shortly after that, and the power of Assyria was broken. And from that point on, the threat was not Assyria, but a small, insignificant city that would grow in power called Babylon. That's the background. That's a 2-minute thumbnail, history's edge. If you want a detailed one, we can speak about it after. Now, I want you to see, please, he was tested by the struggle. I want you to see about this struggle. The battle for Jerusalem. The first thing I want you to notice, please, is that Hezekiah, should I say, first of all, you might think that the people were with him in this, that all the people were with him. But I tell you, the first thing we learn about the battle is this. The crisis tries the courage of everyone. If you were to turn over to the book of Isaiah, for instance, and you were to read over there, you would find in the book of Isaiah that the people are actually saying, in the midst of this crisis, let us eat and drink and let us be merry. Tomorrow we're going to die. There's oil and there's joy and there's gladness. Come to chapters such as Isaiah 22. And so you see, the people faltered in the crisis. It seems quite a simple thing, but crisis tries the fidelity of everyone. And the people did not all stand. They didn't stand shoulder to shoulder with Hezekiah. You know, we used to sing a hymn, Dare to be a Daniel. I've been saying at the conference, Dare to be a Samuel. Dare to be a Hannah. And I'm saying to my young brethren and sisters now, dare to be a Hezekiah. In the day of crisis, he stood firm. But some of the people, the crisis was too great and they collapsed. The crisis of testimony shows me who really is true. And remember, to stand in the crisis is a credit to the Christ who died for you. Crisis of service. Everybody's service goes through crisis. This is the evil day when Satan attacks, and Satan will attack. Don't crumble under his attack. Stand in the crisis. Don't collapse under his pressure. Stand in the crisis. Sad it was that folks in Jerusalem failed to do that. And instead of sackcloth and ashes, it was wine and joy and jubilation. And they're saying, well, we're going to die anyway, so what does it matter? And even as the king was preparing his defences, these folks were doing that. The crisis tested the mettle of everybody. I want you to notice also about this battle, very interesting thing. I want you to notice, please, that the enemy, if you read this, you will find in that great time when the enemy hurled his abuse at Jerusalem, he denied the power of Jehovah. He denied that God was true. That's the second thing I want you to notice. The devil always denies that God is true. The devil always says, as God said, these men say, look at your God. You are a little insignificant nothing. We are the world power. Surely our God is greater than your God. They denied the power of God. The third thing I want you to notice was, they misunderstood appearances. They thought that being little in stature meant that they were powerless. How many men made that mistake? They made the mistake that Goliath of Gath made. Why, you're only little, you're a nobody. And yet he had in his hand a stone that would fell the giant. Hezekiah, you're a nobody in charge of a kingdom that's nothing. We are the great world power of the day. Your God is nothing. They mistook smallness for weakness. Many an assembly, fewness of numbers is mistaken for weakness. Listen, young brother, young sister, it's maybe not a habit here. Am I speaking to somebody who's going to get married? I can't speak about Vancouver. I don't know where you're going or where you're living. But I tell you, don't try to find a place where you can rush into the largest assembly and hide. Get to the assembly that needs you. Get to the assembly that needs you. Don't rush into where you can do that. It's maybe not prevalent here, but sometimes, you know, folks go to large assemblies because they don't want to put their back to the wheel. You see, the crisis tested them. And these folks said smallness of numbers was weakness. We don't want to be where the numbers are small. You're a nothing, Judah. You're a nobody. I tell you this, a small assembly can be a power for God. A small assembly can be a power for God. I've been in assemblies that are very, very large and are as dead as they're big. There are large assemblies that are alive, of course. And I've been in small assemblies that are vibrant with power and a devotion to Christ and an application to the gospel and to the ministry. And young brethren and sisters who are putting their all into the work of God, the enemy mistook size for power. And the devil still today says, if you want to be powerful for God, be big. I tell you, if that had been so, what about the child girded with a linen ephod? What about young David moving down into the valley of Elah? You want to be big? What about 11 men facing the might of the Roman Empire? Nobody's. An insignificant group following an obscure teacher, and they turned the world upside down. Size does not equal divine power. The Assyrians will learn that. Judah's a nobody and a nothing. But 185,000 of their men will lie as dead carcasses outside of the capital city. Size is not power. Godliness, Christ-likeness is power. You have to learn. I want you to observe, please. We better stop observing this and move on. I want you to observe, please, that the battle was preceded, well, the battle really didn't take place, but in the crisis, Hezekiah spread the problem before the Lord. He took the letter and he spread it before the Lord. Listen, He didn't go and spread it before men, and he didn't go running about with it in his inside pocket and say, look at what I've had, looking for their sympathy. It wasn't the sympathy of his followers or his citizens he wanted. He spread it before the Lord. Would to God I could do that in the difficulties of life. Come and spread them before the Lord. Because this man knew that it was God who must win this victory. He did not have the resources to overcome the might of Sennacherib, king of Assyria. So he spread the letter before the Lord. I've got to leave this behind. Well, the sad people of Isaiah 22, eat, tomorrow we die, learned this lesson that they wouldn't die tomorrow. 185,000 of them. 2 Kings 19:35. 185,000 of them. I tell you, the victory showed and proved conclusively that it was God's victory and not Hezekiah's victory. That little nation of Judah couldn't achieve that. Only the hand of God could. And the enemy retreated. Because they let God do the work. Young brother, you know I'm appealing to my young brethren and sisters, but I'm speaking to everybody. You can define how young is young. I just know this, that those who look a wee bit older will have a different benchmark than those who are younger. But nevertheless, this was God working. Let me speak to you for a minute. Do you want to see God working in your life? Do you really want that? Do you prize it above everything? Do you want to see God working? If you want to see God working, and I'm going to say it again, and keep saying it, because I feel I should. There's a cost. There's a pathway to follow. We've already defined that, the cost. We already said last night that putting away sinful things isn't enough. You have to put away unprofitable things as well. You're going out for the evening. Is this just idle frippery? Is it just shallow nonsense? Be gone with that. Is it something that honours the Master? Brings honour to him? Would he sit amongst you? Would he be there? If he wouldn't be there, you shouldn't be there either. And it may not be sinful. But it might just be useless, trivia, and frippery. The prize is to get to know the God of the Bible. The God who saved you. And that prize is beyond any price. And Hezekiah now sees the power of God working. Tested by struggle. Tested by sickness. He fell ill. You say he was wrong to ask for 15 more years. He asked for a sign. The prophet Isaiah came to him. The story's not all here. You'll get it in the centre section of the book of Isaiah in the second book of Kings. And the prophet came to him and said, you're going to die. And he turned his face to the wall. The prophet left. And before the prophet was out of the palace, he turned back and said to the king, your prayer has been answered. He was given another 15 years. You say, well, that was a wrong thing, was it? Was it? This crisis took place as the enemy was at Jerusalem's gates. It was in those days. And if you read Isaiah 38 and 6, we learn that the enemy was at the gate while the king was ill. The enemy was there. The Assyrians had surrounded Jerusalem. And in the midst of the crisis, it's crisis upon crisis. There's the crisis of defending the city. Now the crisis of his illness. 15 years. Why did he want it? Well, he prays and he says, because the dead don't praise you. He wanted to keep worshipping the God of heaven. But is it perhaps that there's born into his mind the awful thought that if he died today, there would not be a next generation of the line of David? Manasseh was not born until after this illness. And some have said, well, that evil king, if he hadn't asked for 15 years, there wouldn't have been that evil king. No, there wouldn't have been any king. I suggest he was looking in the day when the kingdom appeared to be falling. Hezekiah was confident enough to look ahead to its future. Praise God for that. And the, what do you call it, the degrees, the sun went back in the sundial. Some think it was a sundial, probably was. Some think it was maybe the stairs, the tent, doesn't matter. It went back 10 degrees. You say, how can time go back? Somebody said that to me. How can time go back? My brethren, the God who puts time forward can put time back. It is the God of creation who has brought time forward 24 hours since we were last here. The God who makes time march forward can make time march back. That's nothing for God. But it was a remarkable sign. And that remarkable sign confirmed that there would be another 15 years. Listen. He's the God of the impossible. There's nothing impossible with God. You know, we learn that in the book of Genesis. A man of 100 and a woman just about 10 years younger have a child. Is anything too hard for the Lord? He's the God of the impossible. And can I tell you this? When you are praying that God will hear your prayers, remember this. God was prepared to move the planets and the universe for the sake of one praying man. God was prepared to move the sun for one praying man. Nothing's impossible. He's tested by strength. Lifted up a little in pride, the ambassadors from Babylon come. He opens up the treasure stores. Babylon's a nothing. A little insignificant city over there in the east. Moradek Baladin is the king and he's a nobody. Shows them the treasure houses, and has borne into the heart of Babylon a desire to possess the treasure store of Jerusalem. He was at fault there. He failed. My brethren and sisters, just with this I finish. There are some things you show the world and there's some things you don't. Because the one thing the world wants is to take away your riches and take away your strength. Took it away from Samson, and ultimately will take it away from Judah. Sufficient to say this, follow good King Hezekiah, the man whose prayer changed the course of the planets. God was prepared to do that for him. And we learn from the reign of this man, the greatest king, whom they put in the chiefest sepulchres, that nothing is too hard.
So we turn again to John's Gospel, please. Gospel by John and chapter 14. John chapter 14, we have been looking at something of the events of our Lord's last evening and at some of his ministry. He is speaking in verse number 27, John chapter 14. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. Chapter 15 and verse 9. As the Father hath